This is Cade Massey, practice professor at the Wharton School. On this week's highlight show for Wharton Moneyball, we talked to Dean Oliver. Dean is a longtime friend of the show. He's an author of a very influential book in basketball called Basketball on Paper. Longtime analyst, builder of models that ESPN still traffics in. He's been on the coaching staff of NBA teams. He's just been in a lot of places, and he's wonderful to talk about with basketball and other sports. We have a half hour here with Dean Oliver.
From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. Wharton's Business Radio on SiriusXM. This is Cade Massey hosting this week with my longtime co-host, collaborators, friends, faculty colleagues, Audie Weiner and Shane Jensen. Our fourth co-host, Eric Bradlow, is out and about doing Eric Bradlow things. He will be back. Some combination of us are here almost every week of the year and have been for 10 years now. We are delighted to welcome back to the show for the umpteenth time, Dean Oliver, longtime friend of the show, going way back to the beginning of the show. I would say, Dean, one of the best known and one of the pioneering men in analytics of basketball, the author of Basketball on Paper, an influential book in the whole world of basketball analytics, Basketball on Paper 2004. He is, I'm assuming it's a kind of update. He's got another book coming out probably this fall. He says his work with it is mostly done. Basketball Beyond Paper. He wrote Basketball on Paper 2004. Basketball Beyond Paper. We'll hear a little bit about that. Dean Oliver has been beyond basketball analytics. He was responsible for the original good models at ESPN for power rankings in football, for example. He's worked with teams, multiple teams, most recently with the Washington Wizards. Not Bullets. The guys are telling me they're not the Bullets anymore. They're the Washington Wizards. The Washington Wizards. He parted ways, I don't know, about a book ago with the Washington Wizards. We'll hear about that. But Dean, it's always good to see you. Thanks for making time for us.
Good to be here. When did you guys start? You say I've been here for the umpteenth time, but since when? When was that?
10 years, man. We just cleared our 10th year anniversary, March 2014. That was the beginning of Business Radio, Wharton Business Radio. And we were one of the original shows. We're one of only like two original shows that are still surviving. And we're all intact, the same four co-hosts the whole time. So we're hanging in there, Dean. How about you, man? How about you?
Oh, doing great. Yeah, it's a fun time. Basketball is high on the priority list of watching these days, both the NBA and college basketball.
Well, let's
not just men, college basketball too. Wins is great too.
Well, I do want to stretch you beyond your typical professional basketball expertise, which we'll come back to. But we are, of course, just rolling into the Final Fours. Men's Final Four was set over the weekend, and Women's Final Four set as of last night. And it's been great fun, as it always is. I think the women's probably have never received more attention than the. Has anybody seen the numbers, Matt? Do you have the numbers yet on the TV last night? My God, Iowa LSU was not a final. It was last year's final. It was an eight team. Is it a quarterfinal? That's a quarterfinal.
Elite Eight, I guess, round, right?
And it was spectacular. But so, Dean, I'm just curious, how do you consume college basketball and to what extent do you have your analytic lens on in there when you're doing so? How do you tell us where you are in college basketball these days, both on the men's and the women's side?
I'm frankly catching up because over the last 4 years, being on the coaching side, I really couldn't watch a lot of college basketball. When you're in the NBA, it's like you have no time. Your season overlaps with the tournament, so you basically can watch one or two games here and there. Mm-hmm. This year I've been able to watch a little bit more, but I'm still trying to recoup. So, like I watched UConn and I watched North Carolina a lot this year. Well, not a lot, not compared to what I used to. Those are the two teams that I kind of rooted for, and unfortunately both teams are pretty good. But it's always dangerous for your tournament bracket to
right.
Bracket.
Though I don't know. Those are two good heuristics just to have. Like base rates say you're not going to go terribly wrong most years by loading up on UConn and UNC.
Yeah, it was pretty good this year, but I didn't do very well on a lot of the rest of it. But UConn looked like about the best team I've seen in years in college basketball.
Well, say more about that. So on the one hand, people said this is kind of a more open tournament than we usually see. On the other hand, they say the one that stands out is UConn. And so far, man, they've lived up to it. They have, I mean, there must be some examples, some precedent somewhere for how unusual it is to beat teams as badly as UConn has beaten teams over the last month.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering myself. Like, I mean, I think we're used to kind of in a lot of like prediction models not using kind of score difference because it probably is not all that diagnostic for most teams. But this kind of level of dominance seems to me somewhat unprecedented, at least in my kind of like anecdotal viewing like history.
Yes.
Well, I mean, hold on a second. We use score differentials. All Pythagorean models are based on that.
So what were you talking about, Shane? You say we're not used to using it.
Well, like, no, I more mean in like kind of like I would assume most kind of basketball, like most models of like kind of like, you know, predicting wins like team to team is like some kind of ELO thing where score differential is kind of intentionally left out.
You're saying in basketball you think that's the
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Is score differential predictive of future win probability? Let's grind that down. Wasn't my question, but that's worth knowing. And B, if it is it used in models and is this a historically unprecedented set of score differentials?
And I think what we have with UConn, Ken Pomeroy, who has a great college basketball site, very cheap for a lot of people to sign up. He had UConn the best offense and I think the fourth best defense in all of college basketball. And those are adjusted by schedule strength. And it is mostly, net point differential is kind of the definer there when you adjust for strength of schedule. It is a very good predictor. You can probably do a little bit better if you get kind of play-by-play level and you identify those segments of time where, okay, UConn was winning by 40 and with
garbage
4 minutes
time
left to go and they changed their subs and that kind of thing. You can do that sort of thing.
Yeah. I've got a little...
I don't know.
Or I guess maybe let me ask a very specific question. Does kind of cleaning up against, like, during the regular season, dominating lesser opponents and even in the early part of the tournament, dominating lesser opponents, is dominating them versus just beating them predictive of actual continued success in the tournament? That's the real question.
I can't
speak
to basketball per se, but in football, for sure, there's a lot of information in margin, and so much so that, you know, there are these years where there's a team that comes through undefeated, they barely win a bunch of games, and the narrative becomes they know how to win close games, and it's just BS. I mean, good teams beat other teams by a lot, and we've seen that, and I'm assuming it happens in other sports, but it's certainly the case in football.
There was something that I did like 30 years ago, just kind of looking at there is probably some point of diminishing, a significant point of diminishing returns. But it is, instead of winning by 30, you should win by 29 or something
like that.
But
it's
tiny. It's like, oh, okay. It's probably not real.
So some historical reference for what UConn is doing in this tournament. They have the highest cumulative margin of victory going into the Final Four this century. That makes it sound good, right? So the most since 1999, their cumulative margin of victory over the first, what would that have been, four games?
Four games, yeah.
111, plus 111. The record is Kentucky in 1993, 124. And there's a couple others in there. Duke.
Over presumably six games it was.
No, these are four. These are going into
the
Final Four.
So the same. Okay, right.
So
sorry,
great,
my
but
mistake.
It's not unprecedented.
Yeah,
it's top this century, but not.
But they've got time to pile on. They've still got time to break. But
well, we don't know what these other guys did.
Yeah, I don't know where those guys ended up.
You could, let's say that the tournament record is probably within sight still. Dean, what about on the women's side? And again, you are just a basketball fan and with, you know, a fair bit of history across a lot of divisions, a lot of basketball you've seen. What do you make of what's going on with women's sports these days and women's basketball in particular? So, for example, the ratings last night, the we haven't seen the official ratings, but the speculation from insiders was that the game last night between Iowa and LSU is going to top 10 million viewers. That's putting it up there. I don't know how many men's college football games top 10 million in a year. Probably, you know, setting the postseason tight. Regular season men's college football, I don't know, six or eight or something, I'm guessing. That's a guess, but it's not that many. Dean, tell us about women's basketball, at least your perspective on it.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of interesting to me to see the rise of women's basketball as a whole. I think WNBA also did a little bit better after some of the pandemic things too. And I don't know exactly why it's happening. I certainly like some of the style of the game. It's a little bit different.
Talk about that. That you'd be a very good person to talk about that. And it is interesting when you watch it. It does feel like a different sport, but a thoroughly enjoyable one. In some ways, it's even more enjoyable because the style is different. How would you characterize the style difference?
And you know what I would say is I'd say their decisions are quicker, a little bit more automatic. I mean, people say, oh, they pass the ball better. I think their decisions are actually just a little bit quicker. It's like they know each other better, because I think in the NBA, maybe it's the defenses are more sophisticated. I'm not sure. You can always flip a lot of these arguments one way or the other. But when I watch a lot of the decision making, I think on the women's side, I think it's they know where each other is, and they can make those adjustments on the offense and the defensive side pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. That's a super interesting observation. Of course, the stereotype would be, is it too cliche? It is too cliche to say this, but do women just pass more? Is there more assist in women's basketball? I mean, the stereotype would be that gender differences in willingness to share. And do we see it actually play out on basketball? I know that's absurd.
Or, I mean, an alternative would be, I mean, what Caitlin Clark's doing, for example, is, pretty, I mean, that's why we're kind of, why we're kind of focused on it is what she's doing is sort of like unprecedented. And, you know, is like in maybe a sport where there's less of that just kind of unprecedented athletic kind of dominance, typically is teamwork kind of like really sort of like that much more kind of important,
right?
Basically coordination, like, you know, like I don't know enough to know whether or not kind of the coordination game, you know, like, you know, within the kind of game, within a possession, whether that is like more, you know, kind of, I guess, yeah, more cohesive in right. The women's sport versus the men's.
Well, that might explain,
because you can't just dish it to LeBron and have him do something with it,
right? Exactly.
Typically.
If that's true, it might explain why Iowa is such a compelling team to watch right now, because they have both. They have an unbelievable athleticism and exceptional performance of Caitlin Clark, plus all the team stuff. And by the way, Clark does as much impressive. It's almost as, I mean, her shooting is ridiculous. It's Steph Curry-esque. It's wildly impressive by itself. But then her passing is almost as impressive as her shooting, and it's both the traditional assist you see, you know, around the 3-point lane, but also the long passes down court. She has some absurdly high percentage of her assists come from the other end of the court. They cross the midpoint line. It's an absolute ball to watch. It absolutely is so much fun.
So one of the things that I think has helped her and helped the women's game in general too is that they're staying in school. I think that's something that we don't see in college basketball, obviously, as much. Some of the great players staying in school a long time. And when you have these players who are in school 3-4 years and they get consistent minutes and they get consistent teammates and consistent coaching, you know what happens? Those decisions get a lot easier.
Yeah, right.
Decisions to shoot, decision to pass, what to do in certain situations. And I think that makes the game a little bit cleaner.
Absolutely. Well, it should be said, Angel Reese, at least as of last night, the star for LSU, hadn't announced what she was going to do, whether she might even come back for another year. But she was a real pleasure and very different way to watch. She's a low post player, and she's great around the bucket, and she gets it in the bucket from all kinds of difficult angles and just so much grace. And she's brutal on the defensive side of things. It was a lot of fun last night, and I'm sure the Final Four is going to be a ball as well. Dean, tell us more generally about what's going on with you. So you mentioned having come off the coaching side, which was different for you. You've been on the analytics side. There usually is a big divide in sports between the analysts down one hall, the coaches down the other hall. You go in on the coaching staff with the Washington Wizards. By the way, I quoted you. This is the week that you show up in my teaching slides. I have a quote in you. You may not know that I do this. You told me once that you spend something like 40% or at least 40% of your time when you're on the coaching staff not doing analytics, but thinking about how to communicate analytics. So there's a book by a couple guys, Chip Heath and his brother Dan Heath, and they divide our influential efforts between the getting the answer stage and the telling others stage. And they say the typical mistake is you pour all your time into the getting the answer stage and not enough time into how to tell others. And then you came along and said, well, I've been doing this for a while, and it turns out that I spend at least 40% of my time trying to figure out how to tell others. And I quote you in my slides to my MBAs this week, just for what it's worth.
It is true. And on the coaching side, it's potentially more. It depends upon kind of what you're working on. But for sure, a lot of a lot of coaching is teaching and communicating, and you're trying to convey it in different situations, either to the coaching staff or to the players themselves directly. And what you say and how you say it to them, and there's only so many things that you can prepare for. So you better be prepared at least how to communicate it. And that's, I've spent, yeah, a lot of time, and different players have different levels of receptiveness. Mm-hmm. Different coaches have different levels of mm-hmm. receptiveness mm-hmm. and different levels of interest. There were articles about working with Kristaps Porzingis mm-hmm. Last year mm-hmm. with the Wizards and how well that went, because he cared a lot about the numbers. And mm-hmm. so that makes it a lot easier, because if he can think in some of the more advanced numbers, then the communication on why this is a better choice, why taking this shot, not that shot, is better. You can give him an effective field goal percentage, and mm-hmm. you can give him the idea that, oh, this is going to get you to the foul line more, that kind of thing. Whereas if you have to spend more time thinking about how to communicate it at a more base level, then there's less that you can convey. It's still, you can still do it, for sure.
Well, you know, you're such an interesting person to talk to about this, because you have been in the business of communicating analytics your entire career. You've done it through books. You've done it on analytics staffs within organizations. You've done it for media companies, wildly influential in the way ESPN communicated their analytics, and now in a coaching staff. How would you say you've changed? Like, what's an example of a way that you've changed in your efforts to communicate analytics? How have you gotten wiser over that time? What wise advice can you give to the rest of us who are still getting better at communicating analytics?
Smile more. I think it's part of one of the things, frankly, is
I think you're being serious. So elaborate that a little bit.
Yeah, I think some of the day, especially when you're on a coaching staff and you're traveling with the players and the coaches for like 7 months and you're always together, sometimes you can wear on each other. So just being a positive kind of voice, even if you are directing people or giving people advice and things like that, just smile more, because it's like there's a lot of time to be serious, and you want to save those moments for when it is highly important. And you have a lot of time that you can convey. You just want them coming back to you. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think that is something. When I first started off in the NBA, I was super serious about everything. This is important. This is going to win us more games, and games means more money for everybody. All of this kind of thing. But you gotta sit back and enjoy the sport too. I mean, you frankly let yourself enjoy it, have fun with it, have fun with the people. And frankly, there are a lot of very interesting people doing this kind of job.
Well, it's a super interesting distillation you give. You want them to come back to you. I mean, that as a heuristic would guide a lot of behavior. So yes, you want to get something across today, but you care a lot about the opportunity to get something across in the future, which means you want them to come back to you. That could change the way you go about things. That's super interesting. We're going to continue pushing the frontier and trying to get at it. We're going to have to let Dean go, but before you go, Dean, give us the preview on your book that's coming out this fall, Basketball Beyond Paper, as a 20-year later sequel to Basketball on Paper. What can we expect out of this book?
Yeah, the first book was very much about how we measure how good teams are, how good players are. The second book is very much more about why, what causes those things to change. What are the things, from motivation to what kind of practice, what kind of drills, how do you fit players together? All of those things do have an impact on how well players play. And it's covering those topics. It doesn't have all the details of how to measure these things as much, but some of the studies for what it means, what kind of things do actually help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there, in your personal hierarchy, do you have a favorite, or do you have something you consider relatively high on the list? That because what I'm hearing is, you analysts, you don't have the whole picture. You know, we need to go beyond paper and numbers. There are these other factors. If you were to start at the top of the list, what would you point us to?
Well, I think motivation is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, frankly, based upon what I was able to measure in those situations, it was enormous. And in both the anecdotal situations and then the study of garbage time, mm-hmm. those numbers were very high, mm-hmm. Much bigger than what I see in terms of differences in carrying out place, like sideline out of bounds, baseline kind of out of bounds. I think we can do a lot better in terms of practicing shooting. I think there are some teams that already do that, and I think we'll get better with some of those. But those are tougher to actually test what we're doing working, because there's just – you don't want – a lot of people don't want to do experiments with yeah. the most high-end shooters in the world.
Right. But they can do experiments in the G League. Baseball has always had the luxury of experimenting in the minor leagues. They haven't taken advantage of it enough. They have more recently lately, but basketball now has minor leagues. They can run experiments if they want to.
And Daryl Morey did that with the Rio Grande Vipers, I guess it was, there many years ago when they were just running like Loyola Marymount style for a few years.
Right.
They were able to experiment that. And I think different teams have different philosophies for what to do with their minor league team. And that limits some of the experimental
right.
stuff you can do that goes more broad than just the players.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, listen, Dean, thanks, man, for making time for us. Always a pleasure to talk to you. On the way out, tell folks where they can find you. We know that you're on Twitter at DeanO_Lytics, DeanO_Lytics. Where else can people track you down?
I'm there a lot for the most part. I'm doing some work with RoyceWeb.com. I'm writing articles there every so often. I actually did something on the impact of analytics on award voting over the last couple weeks, just showing that it has made a difference in how people vote, that kind of thing. So those are the two principal outlets for me until the book comes out in the fall.
All right. Well, good luck getting the book out. We will look forward to talking to you more about it then.
All right.
Dean Oliver, longtime basketball analyst, book author, and friend of the show here. All right, team, that has been another Wharton Moneyball here on SiriusXM Business Radio. For the crew here, I've been in the studio with Shane Jensen and Audie Weiner. Real pleasure. For Eric Bradlow in absentia, for Matty Datz, the boss man, Mr. Dion Simpkins running the show here in the studio. Great to be in the same place with you. Thanks for all the help. Thanks to you guys for listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.